deep in the heart of the Welsh valleys, a young man had a deceptively young and unfathomably handsome man had decided that it was his destiny to become the greatest dog agility handler the world had ever seen. So he set about learning his craft. His front crosses were crisper than a dry December morning in the Brecon Mountains. His catchkers were slicker than a boiled pigeon in a rubber tube sock. The intensity, accuracy and speed and natural flamboyance he brought far surpassed anything the sport had ever seen and would ever likely see again. The time was approaching where he would be ready to shine on the world stage and begin his legacy. But he realized, to win any battle, you must first know your enemy.
Hello, 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 and welcome to another episode of Know Your Enemy. On today's episode, we have Cynthia Horner. Cynthia trains and competes in the US with her two dogs, Truant and Nimble. And Nimble is one of the reasons that I got a border pack. She's competed very successfully at the highest level for many, many years and has represented the US many times too. At the time of this recording, they've just returned from the EOs in Denmark. I really enjoyed the conversation, and as always, I hope you guys do too. Today's podcast is sponsored by QME Agility Training. It's an online training platform for everyone who competes in dog agility. It is run by the one and only Dave Munnins, and it has modules on literally everything you could ever need to be a successful agility partnership. All in one place, all on one platform. So if you think you need help with anything, take a look at the website and I'm sure Dave will be able to help you get it sorted. If you have any questions, feel free to reach out to either myself or to Dave directly. Okay, so today we welcome along Cynthia Horner. Good morning. Is it morning for you? It's afternoon for me, but I'm assuming it's the morning for you.
It's morning for me.
Well, good morning. I hope you're doing well. How are you?
I am great. Thank you.
Good.
So, a pleasure to be here on your podcast.
Oh, thank you. You're so kind. So I know you guys have just come back from competing over in Europe. How did that go for you? Did you enjoy?
I loved EO. I know there's no perfect event out there, but I really did love the energy of the European Open. My dogs were fantastic. My Border Collie Truant, I got to compete with two dogs this year. And my Border Collie Truant was 5 for 5, clean runs.
Wow.
Got to go to team finals and he was clean on his part of the team finals. So he did amazing. And my little mixed breed border pup, Nimble, she won team jumpers, which was pretty amazing. Unfortunately, we didn't put it together in any of the individual classes, but we have some homework. So when we go back, hopefully next year, we will be ready to go to finals.
Well, congratulations. I saw some of your runs. I didn't catch all of them, but the ones I saw were, you know, pretty impressive. And I don't know if I've told you before, but like one of the reasons why I have my little dog is because I loved watching you run with Nimble. So that's, aww, yeah, definitely an inspiration. But yeah, really cool to see. And you had some great results. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
So we know your name, but who do you see yourself as today? If someone says, who are you? How would you see yourself and how would you describe yourself?
I would probably say that I am a compassionate agility competitor. I love agility. I love figuring out the puzzles to how to communicate with my dog to get the best performance on a course. I also have a family. So I have kids and they're getting older now. So they probably need less help from me. But that is another big part of my life.
Yeah, for sure. I'm the same. I see myself as a dad and a competitor. But for yourself then, would you say you enjoy the competition or the training more?
Both. I actually really do feel I love training. There's nothing I'd rather do than have an afternoon off and just go and train little bits and pieces. I'll set up different things in my agility field. And I just adore that time with my dogs and that bonding with my dogs. I do also love competing. So I think I really enjoy both of it. And I think to be truly successful in the sport, you have to enjoy both. You have to embrace the competitions and you also have to really enjoy doing the training.
Yeah, for sure. I agree with you as well. And you say in your spare time, have you got a job aside from agility or is agility your kind of main job?
I teach agility probably 35 hours a week.
Yeah, so yeah.
Definitely that is my main job.
And you're still able to remain passionate about it yourself, because often, as we know with other people, well, I shouldn't say we know with other people, but often with a lot of people who have a job, then they come home and they don't really want to be thinking about that job anymore. So quite fortunate, aren't we, to be in something that we love as well as have it as our main job.
Absolutely. There are certainly days if I have a very long day of teaching, the last thing I want to do is go work with my dogs, because then you get a little bit tired of agility.
Yeah, for sure.
But that doesn't happen too often. And I do try to take like little breaks within my teaching day where I can grab my dogs for, you know, 5, 10, 15 minutes, obviously warm them up and cool them down, but be able to do 10 minutes of training here and there. And I think that actually works the best for training.
Yeah, I agree. Those short moments that you can do in between, always make sure that you pack the right level of quality and intensity in, mm-hmm. because you can't afford to waste any time, right?
Right, exactly. So I know exactly when I go out to train, what I want to work on, how I want to approach it, and how I want to get the job done, and then work it all positively, and then I can go back to training other people.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. So how long have you been doing agility then, and how did you get into it?
I've been doing agility a very long time. I think I got into it in 1997. I actually bought my first Shetland Sheepdog, and I knew that Shelties needed some socialization because they are a breed that can be a little bit reserved, especially in America. And so I wanted to make sure that my dog got socialized, and I just happened to look at different things that I could take him to. And I stumbled upon an agility trial. I went to the agility trial, and I had a background of growing up competing in horseback riding and equestrian sports. So it was a natural fit. And the next thing I know, I was looking for the local agility club where I could sign up for classes. And so I started, I think my first competition was in 1999. So I've been doing it for a very long time, but I still love it.
I was going to say, because you said, obviously you had your Sheltie and you knew that you needed to do socialization. So did you have kind of like a dog training background then, or was it just something that you were aware of?
I grew up in a household. My mother used to compete with her bird dogs.
Okay.
And hunt trials and field trials with her. She used to breed for her pointers. And so I grew up in a household of always with a love of dogs and doing something with your dogs and that bond. So, and then I adored Shelties from when I was little. So I finally, when I was old enough after college, I could go get my own Sheltie. I did.
What was your first Sheltie's name?
My first Sheltie's name was Ryder.
Ryder.
And he was a great little guy. He, you know, was a little nervous about different things, but he taught me a lot about motivation and perseverance because agility wasn't his forte. I think he did it just to, you know, get cookies for mom. But he did teach me a lot, and we got to do a lot of different things. He introduced me to the sport, and then I got another Sheltie who did a little bit more. And then I got my first border collie who started changing things and taking me to national events.
Yeah, that's cool. It's like I said, you've been in it for a while. So I'm assuming that at some point you've had training from other people, right? You haven't just been totally self-taught?
Of course.
Okay.
Of course.
I didn't want to assume that because I know some people are self-taught, but obviously, you know, that the chances are you've had some lessons or some coaching. So is there a piece of advice that someone has passed on to you that has been the most useful and maybe something that you wish you'd known from the start?
Advice, I think, and I don't know who to attribute to, but remember, it really is just fun with your dogs. Don't take it, you know, we tend to take it very serious, but you want to, at the end of the day, remember it is dogs basically jumping over PVC. And I tend to not get as nervous when I realize you're going to have great days and you're going to have some not learning days. And that's perfectly fine. Also, other great advice that I will attribute to Linda Mecklenburg, who has helped me a lot throughout the years, is that believe your dog is a champion and treat them like they're a champion, and then they will be a champion.
Yeah, I like that one. You're not the first person to have mentioned Linda. She's had a couple of name checks, and I'm sure that there's a good reason for that. Obviously, I don't know her personally, but she's been mentioned a few times by a few different people. So she's obviously well thought of, and I understand how much she has contributed to the sport of dog agility, I suppose, right?
Absolutely, a pioneer and still very relevant today on teaching people. And she has just helped me so much.
Cool. Okay, then, so like I said, you just come back from a trip abroad and you did some competitions. Is there anyone in agility who you really admire, whether it be as a handler, whether it be as a trainer, whether it be as a partnership with their dog? Is there anyone who you watch and really would like to try to emulate yourself or just admire in general?
Oh, there's so many people out there I admire as trainers and as competitors. Jessa Ju and Perry, I admire them as competitors and trainers. Angie, I love her relationship with Sunday, and we compete together, and even though we have different heights when we go to Europe,
yeah,
we compete together in the same height in America, and our dogs are probably, for the height in America, two of the faster ones, and yet we are really good friends. If I want her right there in finals with me, pushing me to be better, so I really do love our friendship that we have together. Who else? European handlers, so many great handlers. When I go to EO and I watch them, there are so many that I really do. I just say, wow, what great handling and what great training and the relationship they have with their dogs.
Does anyone stand out to you?
But it doesn't mean that I want to try to emulate them and beat them someday.
yeah, for sure. I mean, it's all about taking inspiration as well, isn't it?
Yes.
Obviously, you've been in the sport a long while, and I would say in the past few years, even if you're just looking at that, the amount that dog agility has changed has been quite eye-opening in that sense. Now, you've seen agility go through lots of changes, I'm sure, but recently as well, I feel like it's accelerated, going a new direction. So where do you see the sport going, and how do you see it impacting us as trainers and also our dogs?
I believe that the courses are getting faster and faster, better for our dogs, so they can actually be faster, because, you know, distances and the challenges we're asking them for make more sense to the dogs in some ways. And so the good news is our dogs, we need more skills, because we're not going to be right next to our dogs handling them. It used to be, when I first started, you could be pretty much right next to your dog and you could run around, and then your dog would run around and everybody was probably successful. The courses are so much more complex and faster. So I feel that the handler has to have much more better skills on their dogs, better verbals, so their dogs know where they're going, even if you can't be there to help them, at least in my case. Yeah. And I also believe that comes back to a little bit of karma fitness. I feel like handlers need to be more fit these days to attack these courses and handle these courses. Our dogs need to be more fit and just better training skills, so that we can, because the courses keep evolving into faster and more complex for the team.
We certainly see trends as well, I feel, the one that I always stands out for me last year was, and I'm sure it has happened previously, but I just feel it was more prevalent last year, was where, number one, you were jumping away from the course and then the dog comes back into the course. Like, that seemed to be a massive trend last year. Today, I should say this year maybe, is tunnel under the dog walk. And that splits the course to force a layer. I feel like that's been a massive trend this year. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that you predict as coming a trend? Because, like, I think it can only go so far with regards to speed and flow and all that kind of thing. I mean, at a point, it'll have to start going another way. So where do you see it going?
Well, I definitely think that just other layers, I'm noticing courses where you need to layer, because if you do try to go in, you're actually going to put your dog offline, and they're probably going to take a wrong course because of the pressure for the line. So I do believe that we're just sort of starting to see that more and more for the last year or two. So I think that'll become a little bit more prevalent. I do think that probably they'll start backing off of having obstacles, definitely in a handler's path where they have a choice where you could potentially hit an obstacle. So that might back off a little bit, as some people are like, that may not be safe for the handler's path. But I do think that we will continue to see more layers and more distance skills needed.
Yeah, for sure. And if then you could tell someone? So when you obviously primarily you come into it from a competitor's point of view, but obviously when you're watching, you watch it as a competitor, but also as a trainer. Yeah. And there's going to be lots of people listening now who are perhaps not at the level that you're competing internationally, but maybe they want to. So is there one thing that you would say to them that you see as a common either misconception or a common gap in the training that you feel would benefit more people to focus on closely?
I feel on today's higher level courses, definitely just verbals, especially, you know, if you're a very, very fast person, you probably need less verbals, but I do believe everybody needs some verbals because now we're having a lot of those throttle wraps from a distance. Yeah. And if you don't have those on a verbal, your dog's not going to know to wrap that, and they'll start thinking slicing or other things. So as that trend goes, I absolutely think that people need more verbals to help them.
Yeah. And I will say as well, like I consider myself, like my dogs are trained, which I think is a common misconception of me. Like my dogs have got skills, but obviously I try and use my strength, which is my fitness. But, you know, doesn't really matter how fit you are. Judges are now designing courses to make it so that you can't get places. And then, you know, the importance of that verbal is even more to the forefront, I suppose, because you're physically not getting there. So your dog has to be able to do it. And it's quite funny, actually. I don't teach myself much anymore, but I do teach the odd class. It's just a regular class of people who I've taught from foundations. And we were only talking about it yesterday, of just about verbal understanding and how people assume that their dogs have a command off verbal. But as soon as I tell them to stand behind their dogs and just ask for the command, how quickly their understanding kind of goes. And like, we don't often realize sometimes that like physically we help them, right? If we want them to, like, you don't mean to kind of nudge them to a direction, but you might lean in or you might step towards something and that kind of thing. And this, yeah, really, really important to proof the understanding on purely a verbal. And I think some people, I agree, a lot of people miss that kind of, to make sure that it is just off the verbal and not helping them themselves kind of thing.
Correct. I always tell my students that you want your verbal to be able to be successful and proofed enough that the dog can do it without any motion or opposing motion, because if you can run one way and ask your dog to go the other way, then I believe they probably consistently, reliably, and then the dog probably has that verbal. It doesn't mean that when I'm not out on course handling, I am going to try to run as fast as I can and help them as much as I can with motion. But I want to know that if my motion isn't there, if I don't get somewhere, my dog can still perform as I would like them to be.
And I think that's going even one step further from just a verbal understanding as well, isn't it? Is when the body language doesn't back up the verbal. So say you're asking a dog to turn to the right and you're running to the left, then they have to have an even better understanding of just the verbal, because your body and movement is kind of, it's doing the counter to that. And that is where you see the, like the top trainers, the top handlers, that's where they have perhaps progressed a little bit further, maybe, where the dogs are able to kind of do that counter movement and they will override the motion or the movement and still do the verbal. That's so impressive to me. I mean, I know you've got it yourself, and I'm always trying to add. So yeah, that's a really cool skill to have. And I think you make a valid point there.
There was one of the courses at EO. It was a large dog. I believe it was individual, might've been individual agility. And we were put on one side and there was a basically straight tunnel. And if you were really, really fast, you could have got the blind in before the teeter. But for I would say at least half, if not the majority of us, we ended up having to rear cross our teeter. Well, I can't tell you how often I do not rear cross my teeter. And so it was something like, I know I lost a little bit of time there with my dog because it was like, well, what are we doing? I'm like, well, we're rear crossing that teeter now. And there was basically, I tried to send and go, but I knew I wasn't going to make it in for the blind before. So that's when I'm jealous of all the European men that can run so much faster than I can.
I remember that course. I know the exact bit that you're on about as well. Yeah, that was a good bit. If you could, like I said, because agility is moving, sometimes people might say that the rules are, I don't want to say antiquated, but maybe not up to speed with where agility is. So if I could say to you, you can change one rule, and we'll talk about, because you, I guess you guys run under AKC rules for the most part.
Yes.
So is there one rule that I, if I could give you the power to change, you'd change?
For AKC agility?
Yeah, let's talk about AKC, because obviously that's the one I guess you run under the most.
Can I would actually like to change two rules in
AKC
agility.
Yeah, go on, go for it. Change two.
At least. There's probably a few more, but I would like to get rid of our table because it's very antiquated. Like, yeah, why stop on a pause table for 5 seconds?
It always shocks me when I see that in your courses. I'm always like, what is that?
The other thing I would really like, and I do think they are moving to the second part, is I would like greater spacing in our AKC courses for big dogs, because sometimes we really will have 15 feet. I don't know what that converts to meters, but it's not that much.
No, and like it doesn't exactly encourage extension from the dog.
Speed.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, more speed.
It kind of goes counterintuitive to what we're trying to achieve at an international level, where you do need that speed. You teach your dog all that, and then all of a sudden they've got to learn to shorten their stride to make it over the jumps. And it's like, regardless of how not great it is for them physically, it's not great for them from a competitive point of view either. So yeah, I mean, something that we're definitely progressing in the UK. I still think more can be done, and hopefully it will be. And I guess the same for you then.
Oh yes, absolutely. I do believe that at least in the United States, we're getting a little bit more luck. We have started an ISC program. Well, we've always had it, but it's really expanding.
Yeah.
Where we can basically mostly buy courses from foreign FCI judges that we like, and then we can set up trials with those courses, and we can run them. We can use those scores to go to our world team tryouts. So we don't have to necessarily do too much of the typical traditional AKC, which, you know, there are plenty of people who run AKC and they love it and they don't want their program to change. I think getting rid of the table wouldn't be that big of a deal for them. But I think they like it, and we don't want to, it shouldn't be an us versus them or change.
Yeah, for sure.
We don't want to change what they enjoy to get more us more competitive for world team type or international competitions. So it's nice we have our own little niche that we can go and promote and run in. And run the courses that we like to run.
So you say
that is a really nice change, a positive change for the last few years. Yeah. So I think actually that has made the United States teams better.
Yeah.
I think we are getting a little more competitive overseas. This year, I know I think we had 5 podium spots, which might have been a record for the United States. So it did help that there were a few of the courses that were more AKC-ish. So we were a little more familiar with those courses, so we could do well on them.
No, I know what you're saying, but equally, I do agree with you. There are some, you know, you guys have got some good dogs. And as it progresses with regards to the actual competition that you're referring to, I can only see that making it, it's going to increase your chances because you're going to get more familiar with the types of courses that you're going to see when you come abroad and compete. And it's the same for us as well, you know. We were talking about courses then. Is there any judges whose courses you look forward to running? Who's your favorite judges?
Oh my goodness, I have so many. They're usually all FCIs, but I loved Stephanie's courses. So I could go clean on one of her large dog courses. I do. Matter of fact, she's coming and judging in Florida early next year, and I will certainly make my way down there to go compete.
Carla, people who aren't sure, that's Stephanie Semcat, right?
Yes. I love Carlo Fazio's courses. There's just so many. And we're lucky because we're starting Neil Ellis. I like Neil's courses. I did well. He judged our tryouts, and Nimble did great on his courses. And I'm looking forward to hopefully making the team again and going back to EO to run under his courses again. There's just so many. The difference between FCI judges who actually understand how dogs move and, you know, what are good challenges versus not so good challenges. It's just so different than so many of the United States judges. And I don't want to really say things bad about the United States judges, but I feel like they don't really understand lines as well as some of the FCI judges. And I'm not sure why that is the case. And we certainly have some really good judges that do UKI and judge for UKI and even AKC, in the United States, but there are plenty out there that don't really just don't understand how dogs move.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think as well, because you, like you said, you train 35 hours a week. So because you train 35 hours a week, you see lots of different dogs, and that experience yes. level of seeing how different dogs move, it gives you a better idea. In my opinion, that's how you're able to see. Mm-hmm. You know, I can walk on a course and like I can pretty much tell straight away the bit that's going to be awkward. Right. And I think that is, so I always say that I feel judges design a course, you can kind of tell what kind of dog they run. Because if someone thinks that X course is safe, then their dog must be a certain kind of dog. Because
right.
you can walk a course, and I'm saying this to you because, like, you know, Nimble is fast, Truant is fast. You can mm-hmm. walk a course immediately and know the bits that are going to be a problem for your dogs, can't you?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I know designing, I think, is an art form. And sure. I do think it takes a little bit to, you know, understand it and get in a groove. I'm sure even for good judges, they probably had a little bit of a learning curve. I mean, there's certainly some times where I'll do a setup as a seminar presenter. I'll put a setup and I'll watch the first dog and I'm like, oh no, I didn't want it to be like that. So I can tweak it a little bit after the fact, sort of like a white dog. and sometimes at least in the United States, we don't have white dogs. So they can't change the course once it's been set. So then that is the hard part, because then you have to watch all the dogs run on, you know, a little section that maybe you weren't happy with.
Yeah, you and die a little bit inside every time a dog goes wrong.
It's challenging.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so we're going to kind of move away from the specifically agility-related questions. Obviously, any of these can still be related to agility, but it's more about getting to know you. So what do you think people misunderstand about you the most?
Another good question. I don't know, I can be a fairly serious person. So sometimes maybe people think like I am too rushed, maybe like in just because I'm usually so much on my plate that sometimes I am not perfectly good at getting back at people, and I hope they don't take that the wrong way. Yeah. But that happens frequently, and it's just because I have between family and dogs and work and business, I have so many things to do that I can't always be on top of every little bit, every little second.
I think people need to understand that there's other things in life, and, you know, people responding to messages can't always be the priority, and you just do it when you can, right?
Exactly. And there are certain times where I will say I am not responding to anything after like 7 p.m., especially if I'm having dinner with my family time.
Yeah, for sure. You have to set yourself some limits, and I'm the same as that myself, because, like, you know, you want to do your best, but equally you need to give yourself a chance to do your best. And if you're constantly replying, constantly working, then you can't possibly be at your best. You're going to burn out. So yeah, I totally agree with you there. I think it's important to almost set yourself limits, right?
Absolutely. Set some boundaries so that you have your free time too, because everybody needs a little downtime.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I think you kind of go crazy a little.
Yeah, I know, for sure. So what thing then, and it doesn't, again, doesn't have to be dog related, but it can be, what are you most proud of?
I'm very proud of all of my children and their accomplishments and how hard they work. So that first, dog related, I am so proud of all of my dogs. I think in my household, and this is kind of challenging in the United States, but I have five dogs. So I have an older Sheltie and a younger Sheltie. And then I have my retired competition dog, Spice. And then I have Nimble and Truant. And Spice, who is Truant's mother, and Truant and Nimble have all won our AKC Nationals.
Oh, that's cool.
So that's in one household to have three NACs. That's a pretty big accomplishment. So I'm very proud of them for being able to do that. But, you know, I get proud of my dogs just for being able to take a hike with me off leash and not chase deer, or if they think about chasing deer coming back to me. So of course I'm always proud that they're dogs and pets first.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And that is a really cool accomplishment as well. So yeah, congratulations on that. It's probably not many people who've managed to do that.
There are very few. I mean, there are some. Angie's actually won it with three different dogs. I think she's won it four times with three different dogs. So, but it is a pretty rare occurrence where you have, you know, somebody who's won it with multiple dogs.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a test. How would you say it? It's test. No, I'm.
I think it's to me, it's a test of being able to train and be consistent. No matter what dog you're running.
Yeah, but it's a test. And that, I'm trying to think of the word. I'm trying to think of a specific word. It's testament. Testament. I don't know why I had a blinking. I had a moment there where I was losing my mind. It's testament to how good a trainer you are if you're able to repeat it multiple times with multiple dogs, right?
Well, and I've been very blessed to have, you know, some pretty talented, amazing dogs to train. So I will, you know, thank the breeders of those dogs.
Well, that was one question that I have asked in the past, and I think it's a good question. When we talk about like the success of any agility partnership, what do you think the most? Where do you think is the most important part? Is it the training? Is it the dog? Is it the handler? Is it all of those things?
I think it's all of those three things. You can have the most amazing dog out there, but if your handling is not, you know, on time or very good, you probably won't be very successful. If you have the most amazing dog and you are a great handler, but your training isn't that great, then you probably won't be very successful. And you can also be a great handler and a great training, but if the dog doesn't sort of have some natural abilities, you're probably not going to be, you know, incredibly successful either. So I think it takes really the balance of all three. You have, you know, a dog that's talented, has good structure, you know, likes is drivey, and then you're a good trainer to put it together, and you obviously can handle also, then I think you have the whole complete picture.
Yeah, for sure. What annoys you the most, or what makes you mad? And again, it can be in agility or it can be outside.
Well, I'll do both. In agility, what gets me mad or sad is when people will blame their dogs or be unfair to their dogs for their mistakes, because I have a low tolerance for that.
Yeah.
I always feel like, you know, the dogs do the best they can with what we've trained them. I don't mean that there aren't some other type things where, you know, a dog may break a stitch, or I might go and say, no, you're not allowed to do that. But we're talking about handling mistakes, and then they blame the dog. So yeah, that really can be quite annoying to me. In annoying to me in daily life, my guess is, well, right now it seems like people can't drive properly.
You won't believe the amount of people who, when I ask this question, it always comes back to something to do with driving, something to do with being in the car. I think we've all got road rage issues, to be honest. But
I think because we drive so much, at least in the United States, we drive so much to get where we're going for competitions. I mean, it might be that way in Europe too. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
it does seem like we see it all.
I think of it as, because like I've got lots of friends in the US, and I think of like driving 4 hours as being a long drive, but to you, that's just down the road, isn't it?
Oh yeah, it is down the road. I'm getting ready next month. I'm going to the Canadian Open, and I think it's like 14 hours away. Yeah. And then the month after, I'll be going to the US Open, and that's another 13 hours the opposite way.
That's crazy. But like, I mean, I guess it's normal to you because it's something that you live in a place where it's pretty big. So it's kind of one of those things, either you drive or you don't do it at all.
Correct. And I know that flying, especially large dogs in the United States, it's easier for me to fly my dog to Europe, my border collie to Europe, than it is to fly him within the United States, because a lot of our carriers don't take dogs as cargo or in checked baggage. So we're stuck driving.
Yeah, that's crazy, isn't it? best thing that you have bought recently, under $100, $150, that kind of price. I'm not looking for a big thing. Something that you bought and you thought, oh, that was a good buy.
Actually, it was on a recommendation of a friend, and Apple has a new phone charger. It's one of those MagnaSafe ones, but it just connects to the back of your phone, and okay. It's wireless.
Yeah.
And I love it.
Yeah.
It does make the phone weigh a little bit heavier when you're charging it, but I absolutely love that. My most recent favorite purchase.
Good tip. I'm sure lots of people will be checking that out after they've heard that now. So if I have got a crystal ball, and I could give you the ability to look into it to see your future, firstly, would you? And then secondly, if you would, what would you look at? You got one op. You can't look at everything. You get one look.
Can I look at just one aspect of life?
Yeah.
Because
yeah,
it could be a little bit scary. Actually, I don't know if I would look in. Yeah. I think I would not. I don't really want to know how the future is. I think if you knew you went into, say, if I could look in the future crystal ball and it said I was going to win XYZ, I think it would take all the excitement away from it. You know, you have that pre-competition phase where you're very excited, looking forward to the competition, and then the actual competition. And I think if you already knew how it was going to end, I don't think that would be, I wouldn't like that, I don't think.
Yeah, that's a fair answer. So every time I do one of these, I ask the last person who I've spoken to ask the next person I'm speaking to a question. So your question comes from Marita Ogilvie, and she is asking, how many hours a week or how long each week do you spend on addressing your mental resilience or your mental management capabilities? Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. I think the mental game is hugely important to agility. I have read many, many books. I've taken seminars and have worked online with Lanny Basham. And I really do think that you need to go in ready to, you know, attack and not be nervous. And just, I feel like a lot of times you make mistakes on course. It's from mental mistakes. So almost before, without fail, before every big competition, I definitely go back and revisit some of the books that I've read and some of the things, but I also try to work on the mental game during each week too. Probably I would say if I was going to put it into a thing, maybe just an hour, but as I gear up for a big event, it's funny, I start tapering my dog's training down before big events a little bit, just to sort of make sure they're not exactly bubble wrap, but I don't want them to be dead tired before I go to a big competition. So as I do less on their training for the big competitions to taper them, I do more on my mental management. So it really does help a lot.
So you said, you mentioned some books. Is there any that you'd recommend people might want to check out that you really think are useful?
I love the book by Lanny Basham. He has been very inspirational in my mental game, but he has a book called Freedom of Flight, which I really, really like. There's another one by an author, Gary Mack. It's called Mind Gym. And I really like that one also. And it just, both of them are different aspects of the mental game. And there are other ones that are also great, but those are the two that come to mind.
Yeah, I haven't read either of those actually, so that's cool. I'll definitely try and check those out. So let's go into the quickfire round. These questions are ones that don't need any explanation, but might tell us a little bit more about you. What did you have for breakfast?
I had a little bowl of oatmeal.
Cool. What was the last thing you Googled?
I think I Googled the incredible dog challenge information because I just got an invite for Nimble.
Cool. What was the last song you sung?
I try not to sing. People don't like my voice.
Do you not sing on your own in the shower or in the car maybe?
I guess I sing in my car sometimes. So I was listening to U2 on my way home from work last night. So probably one of the U2 songs.
Okay. Do you play any instruments?
I played clarinet when I was younger.
Do you know?
Not in years.
That is unbelievable. That's the most popular answer by a mile. Honestly, I can. like, I'm shocked myself because every time, like, you're about the fifth person to play the clarinet. It's like, what is happening here? Is this some kind of thing that I didn't know about, like a cool clarinet club or something?
Well, actually, I always wanted to play the sax because I think that would be the cooler instrument, but they picked me for clarinet when I was in elementary school.
Well, I started learning the sax. I play a few different musical instruments. I've loved it. And I wanted to play the sax because of Baker Street, right? That's the one song that everyone knows on sax.
Yes.
The problem with learning saxophone is you can't practice quietly. There's just no way. Yeah. And that didn't go well with my neighbor, so I had to pack that in quite quickly. Do you believe in ghosts?
No.
No. Have you got any tattoos?
No. Not that I wouldn't get them, I just don't.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah. What superpower would you have if you could choose?
The ability to be invisible.
Yeah, that's a good one. So before we go, this is my favorite question and is the one I always leave till last. I also have a superpower. I have the superpower of being like Dr. Doolittle, and I can give your animals the power to understand a conversation with you. So if I said to you, you've got 10 seconds to speak to, and we'll just go with the competition dogs. You've got 10 seconds to have a conversation with both your dogs. What would you take that opportunity to tell them?
I would just tell them how appreciative of them I am and how much I adore and love them, no matter what.
Yeah, that's a good one. Make them feel comfortable whatever they're doing, right?
Absolutely. I truly love my dogs. I do think there are probably people maybe in agility now that have dogs more for so they can do agility. And I certainly like to have my dogs be able to do agility. But if my dogs couldn't do agility, I'd still love them and want to have them in my home, in my house,
heart. Well, that is it for the conversation, Cynthia. Thank you so much for giving us some of your time today. But before we go, is there anything that you would like to make people aware of? Anything you want to plug?
No, I think we've covered so much. But thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it. And I look forward to being able to see you maybe next year in England.
Hopefully we've got, it's a great venue. I will say that. And yeah, I mean, it's always something to aim for. And I'm, you know, hopefully I'll see you there for sure.
Yes. Can we order a little less rain maybe next year than this year had in Denmark?
Well, one thing I will say is last year at this time, we had the most unbelievable heat wave. And now this year, it hasn't stopped raining. It's like the complete polar opposite. It's unbelievable. But yeah, I mean, I'll do what I can. I'll get my sun dances out of the cupboard and we'll keep our fingers crossed, I think.
Hopefully.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your time. If you want to say goodbye to everyone, now is the time.
Thank you. Bye. Nice to see everybody.
See you later, guys. And that is the end of the podcast. Thank you for taking some time out of your day to listen. I really hope you enjoyed. If you think you might know someone else who would enjoy, feel free to pass on all the information and share the podcast with them. And get involved on any of the social media platforms. It really helps the podcast grow, and I really appreciate it. See you in the next one.